Hey there, fellow refugee, what's up? From the front seat, Joey called.
Follow protocol. You say over when you're done talking.
Joey, leave her alone, Mom said. I pressed the walkie close to my ear, trying to hear over their yakking.
Who am I talking to? The voice asked. He sounded young.
Carrie Sadonopoli, who are you?
Marcus Abreu. Nice to meet you, Carrie. Is that Carrie with a K or a C?
A C, I said. Why, you planning to write me a letter? Maybe send an email?
Marcus broke out laughing.
You never know. Where are you headed, Carrie?
Colorado Springs. There's a huge underground installation there. Steel doors, a food supply. Or so my uncle says.
Colorado Springs, that's a long way, Marcus said.
Uncle Joey slowed as they passed a tank in the road, its hatch open. Well, we don't have any pressing engagements to get to. My school is on permanent summer break since all of the teachers were eaten and all.
Marcus laughed again.
Hey, what a coincidence. All of my teachers were eaten, too.
How old are you?
I pulled the lipstick from my pocket, twisted the cap with one hand.
16? What about you?
Hey, major coincidence. Same here. In fact, today's my birthday.
Marcus sang happy birthday while Mom laughed, and Joey complained that we were running down the batteries. Not that we didn't have a crate of replacements in the back, more than enough to last until the end of the world. When Marcus finished, he said,
That's a terrible song.
Isn't it? I was just thinking that.
Marcus was with his sister and a friend. They'd been out of town at a swim meet the day the invaders came. As far as they knew, their parents were dead. They were heading toward the Pacific to see if they could locate a boat that had been overlooked that was fast enough to outrun Buzztops. They were dreaming. They were also headed in the opposite direction from me. My spirits plunged. Talking to Marcus was the best time I'd had in months. Evidently, Marcus was enjoying it as well, because we went on talking as the signal weakened.
At least my mom got 46 years of a normal life, I said softly, hoping Mom couldn't hear.
We got 16. Now I get to spend the time I have left stuffed in the back of an SUV listening to my relatives argue. I may never sleep in a bed again.
Life is screwing us over. Sometimes when I'm at my darkest, I wonder if I'd be better off if the termite...
Marcus's voice faded into static.
What was that? I didn't hear the end.
I can...
His voice faded out, then returned. You either.
Shit, I said under my breath. I'd give anything to be able to go on talking to him, even for just another hour. I pressed the reply button. Good luck. I wish we'd had a chance to meet.
Too happy.
I only caught a snippet, but I got the gist. Me too. Happy birthday.
Bye.
I set the walkie-talkie on the seat beside me and tried not to cry. If I'd been alone, I would have. But the last thing I needed was my uncle mocking me, or worse yet, attempting to console me.
How could you have any sort of life if you could never stop anywhere for more than a few minutes?
Man, what I wouldn't give for a hamburger right now,
Uncle Joey said.
Medium rare, mustard and mayo, a thick slice of onion on top.
Don't talk about food, Mom said.
Hey, I don't get to eat good food anymore. Don't tell me I can't talk about it either. This ain't Russia.
I closed my eyes, stuck my fingers in my ears, and tried to go to sleep. But I couldn't. I kept thinking about Marcus. What did he look like? Actually, I didn't even care that much what he looked like.
What kind of name is a bro?
I called, interrupting the argument.
Hispanic, Uncle Joey said. There was a ball player named Bobby Abreu. Good player. His skin was medium well. South American or something.
Medium well. Lovely. He was going to talk about food one way or another. I wondered if we were better off heading back toward the coast as well. It was sunny on the coast, so less risk of a string of cloudy days depleting the SUV's solar battery. When you got down to it, though, fast ships weren't much safer than cars. You could see Buzztops coming, and they couldn't corner you on some dead end. But if your ship broke down, you couldn't just run to find a replacement. You were a sitting duck if you couldn't get the boat running again. Those were the only real options. Ship, car, steel bunker. Even if you stayed close to your vehicle, Staying still out in the world was not an option. You didn't always get a warning that buzztops were headed your way. I woke as the SUV slowed. It was dark out.
I almost hit him,
Joey said, rolling down his window. A guy in military fatigues bent to talk to Uncle Joey through the window.
Man, am I glad to see you. I broke down. Can you take me somewhere I can find a replacement? You got it.
Joey gestured toward the back door. The guy climbed in. His name was Tyler. Mid-30s, heavy reddish beard, wide, beefy face. After introductions, he asked the standard question.
Where are you headed?
Colorado Springs, Aunt Marie said.
She always sounded kind of angry, even when she was saying the most mundane thing.
We heard there's a secure installation there with...
She trailed off because Tyler was shaking his head.
Don't bother. Cheyenne Mountain is sealed tight. Half the politicians in the country are holed up there. The ones who survived the first days, anyway. Unless you're all related to the president, they'll shoot you before they let you inside. You military?
Uncle Joey asked. I could see his dark, deep-set eyes in the rearview mirror.
Ex-Marines. But my rank's nowhere near high enough to get me into Cheyenne.
You tried? Mom asked. Tyler nodded.
Hard. You know any more about what's going on than what we got on the news before communication went dark?
Joey asked. Tyler grinned.
I might.
He unzipped a pouch on his pack, pulled out a phone pad.
And seeing as how you were kind enough to save my ass, I'm willing to share. Not that it'll help you stay alive, but it's damned interesting.
He called up a video, handed the player up to Marie. She held it so Joey could see as well. All I could see from where I was sitting was that the video was shot outdoors in the daytime and was shaky and amateurish.
What is this?
Uncle Joey asked. Tyler waited a beat before answering.
That's what's on the other side of the portals.
I just about crawled over the seat, trying to see the screen as people shouted in surprise.
Let me see. Pass it back here.
My heart was thudding. Someone had seen the other side, where the buzztops and the gigantic whale things that carried the buzztops came from. It must be a horror show, something out of my nightmares. I wanted to see.
That was filmed from this side,
Tyler said as Aunt Marie and Uncle Joey watched, with Mom looking over their shoulders.
You can take a camera through.
I was just about to climb over the seat when Aunt Marie finally passed the pad back to Tyler. He re-cued the video and handed it to me. The video was looking down from a height onto a huge city winding along a river. The buildings were ink black, hundreds of stories tall, and were connected to each other so they looked like one huge twisting maze. It reminded me of an endless factory. Either there were no windows or it was all windows. It was hard to say which. Silver lines that looked like mercury rising and falling and old-fashioned thermometers snaked in all directions, moving around and through the buildings. They must be how the aliens moved around. The city was surrounded on three sides by wilderness. There was an uninterrupted mat of tightly woven green and black vegetation, and jutting out of it were trees topped with black and purple canopies as big as hot air balloons. It was terrifying and beautiful. My throat clenched as I tried to swallow.
This was made by a special forces platoon that eventually went through. They were hoping to send a nuke through, but they couldn't even bring their rifles.
Tyler said as I rewatched the video.
You can't get anything metal or plastic through. It's like they've got a one-way filter to protect them from just the sort of attack we were contemplating.
I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. A river passed through the city under arches, the water blue-green like the sky on one side, but where it flowed out, where it was wider, it ran red. I thought I saw the tiniest of specks moving around, but it may have been my imagination, and if not, the footage was shot at too far a distance to make them out.
Who lives there? The buzztops?
I asked. Tyler shook his head.
The buzztops just transport materials through the portals. The things in charge walk on two legs. Based on what our analysts saw, their best guess is they import food and raw materials from the outside so they can keep their world pristine.
The SUV slowed.
I guess we're not going to Colorado Springs. So where are we headed?
When no one answered, Joey glanced back at Tyler.
Where are you headed? To find my family? Then I'm not sure. I'm thinking of going the cave route.
I'd never liked the thought of hiding in a cave. You had to go deep with ropes and flashlights because the Buzztop swept caves and subway tunnels close to the surface. While you were on your way down, you just had to pray no Buzztops showed up. Plus, it was cold down there, and there was no food except what you brought down with you. Unless you wanted to eat bats. Definitely not my thing. Not that driving around trying to outrun them forever was my thing. I cleared my throat. We should head for the coast. One direction was as good as another. Why not head in the same direction as Marcus?
We tried that, Marie shot back.
You have a better idea? I asked. Marie twisted in her seat to glare at me.
Sweetie, you can have a vote when you're 18.
Hey, Mom said to Marie, don't talk to her like that. She has just as much right to an opinion as you.
While Tyler sat looking out the window, the other three supposed adults in the SUV argued about whether I was a full voting member of the vehicle. The argument then drifted into where we should go. In the end, we dropped Tyler off at a house with a working SUV, then headed back toward the coast, because, just as I'd suspected, no one had a better plan.
Anyone out there? Marcus, can you hear me?
I let go of the talk button and waited. Nothing. Before the invasion, it hadn't bothered me that I was still a virgin. A lot of my friends weren't. Rachel wasn't, after her family took a month-long trip to London, and Rachel met a Dutch guy named Henrik there. But I hadn't been eager to rush into the world of birth control and hoping my period came. School and swimming and life in general had seemed stressful enough. Not that, in retrospect, any of those things seemed even mildly stressful now. Now, though, I wondered how I would ever conceivably have sex. Getting naked in a bed in a house would be suicidal. The alternative was to have sex with someone in a moving vehicle while a third person drove said vehicle. That was out of the question. There was also the question of how I might meet and get to know this guy who would be my first. How many guys around my age were even still alive? Which got me thinking about Marcus. He might well be my last chance. The last kind, funny, interesting guy I'd meet before the Buzztops got me. Or him. I tried the walkie again.
Can anyone hear me? Marcus?
The walkie crackled back to life.
Carrie! Carrie, Carrie, Carrie!
It was Marcus.
Hey everyone, Carrie's back!
I heard his friends cheering in the background, which made me feel incredibly good.
I thought you were headed for Colorado.
We talked to someone who'd been there. Dead end.
I'm sorry. But honestly, also kind of glad. It's good to hear your voice again.
Yours too, I said.
I wish I could see you. Hey, what road are you on?
I looked for signs out the window. I never paid attention to what road we were on. We stayed off the interstates. When you ran into Buzztops, the more directions you had to flee in, the better.
What road are we on? I called.
Route 20, Joey said. We just passed the turnoff of Route 75.
When I relayed this to Marcus, he whooped into the phone.
You're 15 miles behind us. We'll slow down. See if you can get your uncle to speed up.
Uncle Joey?
I called.
I heard him.
The SUV picked up speed. I ducked below seat level into my room and checked my face in the mirror taped to the seat back. I definitely needed work. I brushed my hair, reapplied the lipstick from my back pocket, my palms sweaty. It was silly for me to be nervous. All I was going to be able to do was wave to him. Still, it was the closest thing to a date I was probably ever going to manage.
White Lincoln Sunburst,
Uncle Joey called. I leaped up, peered out the windshield. There it was, disappearing around a curve in the road, a few hundred yards ahead. I grabbed the walkie.
I see you.
I see you too.
The sunburst eased partway onto the shoulder.
Pull up beside us?
When we catch up, pull up beside them, I called to Uncle Joey.
Yeah, yeah.
My heart was in my throat as we closed ground, which was stupid, but I couldn't help it. We pulled beside the sunburst.
A guy with a broad face, Asian-looking eyes, and the cutest smile waved from the rear window, a walkie-talkie in his hand. He brought the walkie to his face.
Can you tell from over there that I'm gawking at you like a moron? I'm hoping you can't.
I grinned like an idiot, unable to think of a reply. Up front, Joey muttered something about guys and their corny lines. If I hadn't currently been using the walkie, I would have thrown it at his head. I pressed the reply button.
You gonna ask me to the prom now or what?
He raised his free hand where I could see it and snapped his fingers.
I forgot my tux. How about a walk on the beach?
Uncle Joey sped up, tucked their SUV in front of the sunburst.
Okay, that's enough. Last thing we need is to get in a head-on collision because you want to flirt.
I could feel myself turning red from a mix of embarrassment and rage.
I'm not flirting!
This was hell, having my relatives hear every word I spoke. It was impossible to have even one normal moment.
Sounds good to me, I said to Marcus. I could use a little time away from this clown car.
Hey! Marie turned in her seat. Joey's the one busting your chops. Don't blame it on me.
I'm not busting the chops,
Joey said.
I'm just saying I don't want to get us all killed.
It's a date then, Marcus said over the walkie.
I could just barely see his profile through the reflections of trees and buildings on the glass of the sunburst. I released the button and handed the walkie up to the front.
We pass a car once a day, if that. You could have driven beside them for an hour and we wouldn't have risked an accident.
We're not going to the beach,
Joey said.
Being at the beach is like backing ourselves against a wall.
You can drop me off and drive. I'm going.
The thought of taking a walk on the beach with a guy my age, listening to the ocean surf and seagull cries, it was worth risking what was left of my highly abbreviated life. I couldn't wait, and there was no way anyone was going to stop me. Mom was contemplating telling me I couldn't do it. I could see it in her eyes, in the way she was chewing her lower lip.
You don't even know this guy,
Uncle Joey said.
I don't know anyone.
I pounded the seat back. The walkie-talkie crackled.
Carrie, you still there?
Mom handed the walkie back to me.
I'm here.
So seriously, we're gonna do this?
I looked right at my mom.
Yeah, we're going to the beach. Maybe we'll even take a swim.
Mom had a deep frown line between her eyebrows, but she didn't say anything. She could sense how much this meant to me.
Awesome!
He sounded as excited as I was.
So what do you like to do when you're not running from aliens?
Marcus asked. I settled back against the door, pulled my green and gold, school colors, blanket to my waist and settled in for the ride. We talked for hours. We used our otherwise useless phones to play our favorite songs for each other. I actually laughed a few times. My laugh sounded so weird to me, probably because I hadn't heard it in so long. Marcus was an inch shorter than me, which seemed the perfect height for him to be. He introduced me to his sister, Jurelia, and his friend, Porter. I introduced him to my family, then we set off down the beach. As soon as we were out of sight, he reached out and took my hand. It was crazy what we were doing, completely insane. The odds that Buzztops showed up on that stretch of beach on that afternoon weren't too high, but if they did show up, we would die. For me, that risk only added to the magic of walking in the surf, my fingers laced with Marcus's, our shoes and socks waiting in the sand by the parking lot.
I'm gonna think about this every day, for as many days as I have left.
Foamy seawater washed up Marcus's ankles, wetting the ends of his rolled-up pants.
Me too.
I squeezed his hand. A seagull cried out, gliding on the breeze. The Buzztops couldn't catch them. You found dead emaciated birds on the ground the Buzztops had stripped because they couldn't find anything to eat, but the Buzztops couldn't catch them. Marcus slowed.
I hate to say it, but we better turn around.
I sighed.
Yeah.
We headed back, not saying much, just drinking it in. Marcus's friends were splashing around in the water, laughing, screaming, while my family leaned up against our SUV and watched.
I wish I was in your car.
Marcus shrugged.
We've got room.
I laughed at the idea of it. I couldn't leave my mom. She'd be devastated. So would I. Marcus went on holding my hand as we approached. It felt good that he didn't let go as soon as we were inside of his people.
What if we went on caravanning for a while and I rode with you? I asked.
Marcus grinned.
That would be fantastic.
Your friends would be okay with that?
They'd be thrilled. We're kind of sick of each other. They'd love to hear a new voice for a change.
You know this for a fact?
I'll have to ask them, but they'll say yes.
I don't know if my mother will.
He looked toward the SUV.
That I can't help you with.
As we walked, I tried to think of a way to ask. She had to let me do this.
No, I shouldn't ask. I should tell her. Back when you could count on having another 70 years of life once you turned 18, you could tolerate being told what to do until then. But there was no way I was going to make it to 18.
They were standing around the SUV, Uncle Joey with his arms folded like he had some important meeting I was keeping him from. As I approached, he rolled off the bumper and headed for the door.
Let's go.
Hang on, I swallowed. I'm going to ride with them for a while. We'll stick close.
Mom's eyes got huge.
What? No, absolutely not.
She studied my face like I had a smudge on it or something.
We're family. We stick together.
She pointed at Marcus, who was huddled close to his shivering friends, talking.
Would they die for you? Anyone in this vehicle would die for you like that.
She snapped her fingers.
I don't know if they'd die for me. Right now, I'm not thinking about dying for the first time in 4 months. I'm thinking about living for a change.
His head down, Uncle Joey came over to me. He grabbed my elbow.
Let's go. Get in.
I yanked my arm free.
No!
Suddenly, Mom was beside me. She locked both hands around my arm. Aunt Marie grabbed the back of my sweatshirt and pulled. I struggled as Uncle Joey opened the back door.
Let go!
Marcus ran to block the door, his friends right behind him.
Hey, let her go!
Uncle Joey tried to shove Marcus out of the way.
Get off me!
Marcus shoved Joey right back, hard, making him backpedal a few steps.
Stay out of this, Mom said. It's none of your business. If you're dragging her into your car against her will, it is our business,
a woman said, probably Marcus's big sister. A second guy sidled up to Marcus, forming a wall in front of the door. Marcus looked at me.
It's your decision. If you want to go with them, I'll move.
No, I want to ride with you for a while.
I looked to Mom. She was crying quietly, her whole face shaking.
It's no big deal. I have a chance to make some friends. Maybe my last chance. We'll stay right with you, and I'll switch back in a couple of days.
Swear to me you will, Mom said.
I swear.
Is that what she was afraid of? That I'd like my new friends so much I'd just drive off and never see her again?
Mom, I wouldn't just leave you.
She didn't say anything, just stared at me, head tilted, like I was someone she'd met a long time ago and she was trying to remember who I was.
Monday, you come back at dusk, she finally said. After that, we'll see how it goes.
I hugged her fiercely. We both knew she wasn't so much giving me permission as accepting what I'd already decided, but I was glad to be leaving with things less ugly than they'd been a minute before. I took Marcus's hand and ran to his vehicle, my hair blowing in the sea breeze. Pork belly came blaring out of the stereo as Marcus's sister started up the sunburst. The wheels kicked up sand as we followed my family's SUV. With Marcus's arm across my shoulders, I lowered the window and whooped at the blue sky. The rest of them whooped in reply as we fishtailed onto the main drag, the ocean at our backs. Marcus handed me a travel cup, and before I even brought it to my lips, I knew it wouldn't be fruit juice. Rum, flavored with a splash of Coke, burned its way to my stomach. I leaned over and kissed Marcus, surprising him, but after a second he wrapped his arms around me and kissed me back. In the rear view, I could see Jurelia watching us, grinning, no doubt happy to see Marcus find a little joy in this fucked-up world.
Hey, I'm 16, I said to Jurelia. Can you teach me how to drive?
Marcus took the travel cup from me.
None of this if you're gonna drive.
As he set the cup in a holder, my last doubt about Marcus and his friends vanished. It wasn't just luck that they were still alive. They were smart and careful. I needed both of my hands, but Marcus kept one of his on my knee. We'd been connected by touch almost continuously from the moment I jumped into their SUV. I think we both recognized that we didn't have time to take it slow.
So, Carrie, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Marcus asked.
No talking to the student driver. She needs to concentrate,
Jurelia said. It wasn't that hard. All I had to do was follow the bumper of my family's SUV. A film director? You?
Psychologist.
5 more minutes, then we'll switch out, Jurelia said. Nice first lesson, Carrie. You earned a second.
She lifted the walkie-talkie to tell my mom we were going to pull over and do another quick switch. There was a bright flash ahead of us and to our left. I jolted. The SUV swiveled, but I straightened it out. Suddenly, everyone was shouting at once.
Go! Turn around! Fast as you can! Turn! Turn!
It filled the landscape, crushing buildings as it surged toward us like an ocean liner, huge, gunmetal gray. A whale. A gate had opened right on top of us. As I turned around, I saw Uncle Joey trying to do the same thing, only the buzztops were already on top of them. I bumped over the curb as Mom came on the walkie-talkie.
Run, Carrie, run! I love you so much!
In the background, Uncle Joey was screaming.
I love you too, Mom!
I cried.
So much!
The walkie cut out as I floored the SUV.
Look out!
Marcus shouted. I jerked us hard left as buzztops surged out from behind a strip mall to the right. They'd gotten in front of us in the time it took to turn around. Only there was no road going left, only entrances to parking lots. I made a U-turn, hoping we'd hit a crossing street before we reached the oncoming buzztops, but there was no way that was going to work. Everyone was screaming. I'd imagined this moment so many times. The whale thundered by, not 100 yards away, spitting buzztops. It would go back through the gate once it had discharged its cargo, back to that strange and beautiful world with its endless forest. That world where there were no marauding buzztops, where a few people just might be lucky enough to disappear into the forest without being seen. I jerked the wheel to the left and headed right at the whale.
What are you doing?
Marcus screamed. We bounced over the curb into the parking lot of a Wendy's. Buzztops closed from both sides, releasing smaller ones to come inside and get us. We flew over another curb, crashed through the wooden fence surrounding the Wendy's, went up an incline, over railroad tracks, back down, and into the wake of the whale. I turned right, away from the whale, and floored it as Jurelia screamed, as Porter screamed, as Marcus screamed, and buzztops closed from all sides. We were in a shopping center parking lot, heading right for the side of a supermarket, but the wall was hazy, like there was something between us and it. There was a blinding flash, and suddenly I was hurtling through the air. My ears popped as the air went from warm to cool, the sky from powder blue to turquoise. I hit the ground, landed hard, bounced and rolled across vegetation. When I finally came to a stop, I was sure I'd broken every bone in my body. I couldn't breathe. My lungs relaxed all at once, and I inhaled a rush of weird mint and pepper-scented air. I struggled to my hands and knees. There was no one around except us, although the vegetation was dead and flattened as if this was a high-activity area. The air was cool, the sky blue-green and brilliantly clear. The SUV was gone. Of course it was. No metal or plastic could get through the gate. My family was gone as well. I heard their screams, squeezed my eyes shut. Mom was gone. I'd lost so many people, but I'd never expected to lose her. I always figured we'd die together. Marcus was lying 10 feet away in thick black-purple weeds. I struggled to my feet, relieved to discover none of my bones were broken. We were in a clearing, the black city maybe a quarter mile away, the seamless buildings towering high overhead. The din of an army of whales and buzztops was just a few hundred yards to our right. My arms and legs were scraped and bleeding, my side throbbing, blood seeping through my t-shirt.
"We have to go," I said. "This must be the exit. Sooner or later, the ones that went in are going to come back out."
The sound of my voice snapped the others out of their stupor. Marcus crawled to his feet. Jurelia must have landed head first because she had a bad cut on her scalp and looked woozy. We limped ran over to a rise in the strangest fucking forest there ever was. The vegetation formed a roof 10 feet off the ground. Below that was bare ground broken up by the boughs of trees and plants. As we headed under the canopy, the ground was mottled sunlight and darkness and splattered with animal droppings large and small. We kept going until Jurelia collapsed, then huddled together in animal shit, our eyes big, as living things made chittering and groaning and popping sounds all around us. I'd only known Marcus and his people for 2 days, and suddenly, in this place, I felt like I was sitting with 3 strangers. I wanted my mom. I wanted my people. I kept hearing Uncle Joey's scream in my head. I couldn't make it stop. I'd been so tired of being treated like a kid. Now the only thing I wanted was to be a kid just a little longer.
"How are we going to get back home?" Porter asked.
"We're not," Jurelia said. "Why would we go back? There's nothing for us there."
I nodded, too exhausted, too devastated to speak. Of course we were staying. There were no buzztops chewing up this world. Porter looked mortified by the idea of spending his life here, however long that turned out to be. I didn't blame him.
"How are we going to know what's safe to eat? What if there are wild animals?"
"We'll figure it out," Marcus said.
"Or we'll die," I heard myself say. "But at least dying's not guaranteed."
Marcus reached out and touched my knee.
"We'd all be dead already if it wasn't for you."
"We would," Jurelia said. "Thank you, Carrie."
The tightness in my chest eased a little. I still missed my people badly, but suddenly I didn't feel surrounded by strangers. Something round and purple dropped from above. I stopped walking as it bounced twice and rolled to a stop at my feet. I picked it up. It was spongy, sort of hairy. I dug my fingernails into it and broke it open, praying it wasn't filled with flesh-eating bugs. It wasn't. The center was purplish liquid. The meat looked suspiciously like fruit. I lifted one half to my nose. It smelled vaguely like chocolate or coffee.
"Hang on,"
I called to the others, who were walking ahead of me. Someone was going to have to be the guinea pig, and if it was going to be me, I wanted them to know what I died of. I took a bite. It was surprisingly chewy, more fruit roll-up than fruit, but it was indeed vaguely chocolatey. I swallowed. Everyone stood perfectly still, watching me. As the minutes stretched out, the silence started getting weird.
"You know what?" I said. "I don't think I'm going to die."
Marcus held out a hand.
"Let me try it."
I drew it away. "We should wait a few hours in case it's slow acting." 3 more purple balls dropped through the canopy. Not 2, not 4, but 3. I looked up. A yellow eye was peering down at me through a gap. I jumped back and shrieked, and the eye disappeared.
"What?"
Jurelia was looking up at the canopy.
"What did you see?" "Something was watching us."
Part of me didn't want to know what was attached to that eye, but I still wasn't dying from eating the purple fruit, so whatever it was, it must have helped us. Either that or it was trying to lure us to our deaths, but we were 4 unarmed people, alone on this world. If something wanted to kill us, it didn't need to be sneaky about it. We decided we had to go up there. One by one, we shimmied up the bough of one of the big trees and squeezed through the gap between the tree and black vegetation. When I popped free, I found myself on a trampoline of vines, underneath an enormous black-boughed tree that had one blood-red parachute-shaped leaf ringing the top. Hundreds of fat, snake-like things were crawling up and down the bough, covering it, somehow not falling. Then I realized they were connected. They were like hands with four or five long, fat fingers. There were smaller trees overhead as well, some of them covered in yellow berries instead of leaves. One was dotted with a purple fruit. I moved closer to it, stepping awkwardly on the springy surface. I caught movement out of the corner of my eye, spun to find a creature standing beside a cluster of fluffy shrubs. It had more limbs than I could count, a wide body that seemed all head. I couldn't see any eyes, just a gaping round mouth. The thing tore off a piece of the shrub and ate it, chewing slowly, its mouth opening and closing, like it wanted to make sure we could see it was eating. Or maybe that was just the way it ate.
"Could it be one of the aliens who live in that black city?"
Marcus asked. "The soldier we picked up said they walked on two legs." "This thing walked on 50 legs." It turned, headed off at a slow pace.
"Should we follow it?"
Marcus asked. We followed it to a copse of trees with wide black leaves that reminded me of the outside of an artichoke. It picked a fallen leaf off the ground and took a bite.
"I think it's showing us what's edible," Jurelia said.
I clapped my hands together and laughed. It was, like a neighbor welcoming us to the neighborhood with a covered dish. As we watched it, it pointed at the sky. I looked up. Was it pointing at those parachute trees? Maybe to tell us they were edible too? It lowered its limb, then pointed up again. There was nothing up there but blue-green sky. My head exploded. Holy shit! I'm from the sky. Is that what it's trying to say? I pointed to the sky as well, then I pointed at myself. It repeated the gesture, took a step forward. I took a step forward. We're from the sky, too. I pointed to myself, then at the sky. I was crying. Marcus was beside me, grinning. He pointed at himself, at the sky. We weren't the first to think of escaping through the gate. Why would we be? Maybe there were others as well. The creature suddenly took off, moving incredibly fast. It went about 50 feet, then dropped through the web of vines and out of sight. Jurelia shrieked. She was staring behind us, wide-eyed. Dozens of snake things were slithering silently toward us.
"We gotta get down! Down!"
Marcus grabbed my arm, pulled me toward the spot where the alien had gone. We reached a ragged hole in the canopy. I scrambled through it, hung from the edge for a second before dropping to the ground. The alien was waiting close by. It watched as Porter, Jurelia, and Marcus dropped through the hole one after another. Then it turned and skittered off, heading away from the city.
"I guess we should follow it," I said.
We let the creature put some distance between us, then we set off after it. Not taking his eyes off the creature, Marcus patted my shoulder.
"I think maybe we're gonna be okay, Carrie with a C."
Water Babies by Maya Catherine Bonhoff. Omar Navarro adjusted the sonar array and took a second look at the infrared imaging. He could have sworn he'd seen a sudden, large flash of ambient heat about 100 yards off the port bow of the submersible. It was in an odd place, though, a relatively narrow dead-end canyon at the end of a shallow trench. As he attempted to relocate it, it returned as a sustained event of obviously variable temperatures.
"Hey, Professor," he said, "you might want to take a look at this."
Professor Corwin Wynn Lerner, head researcher at the International Cetacean Institute, turned from his study of his laptop screen to Omar's infrared display.
"Now that's something,"
the professor said, adjusting his glasses on the bridge of his nose.
"What, though? I mean, it looks like a fumarole."
Lerner gave the younger man a sidewise glance.
"Since your last posting was a geological survey, I suppose that makes sense."
The professor peered at the eddying heat signature.
"Recalibrate, Omar, then assess." "Well, possibly a large, closely grouped cluster of aquatic mammals, dolphins most likely."
Wynn Lerner grinned.
"Shall we go see?"
This was exactly the sort of thing they'd hoped to encounter on the new submersible's shakedown cruise ICI-2, a.k.a. Icky II, was less than a week old and just now getting a full test of her equipment and systems. Omar piloted the submersible into the mouth of the little canyon, carefully avoiding the walls. They had just tucked into the narrow cut when the heat signature altered, seeming to break apart into separate entities. Definitely dolphins. The walls of the box canyon opened out a bit as they motored into visual range, Icky's headlamps reaching into the swirling gloom like the hands of an inquisitive toddler. They picked out the shapes of six individuals, all with the elegant shape of the short-beaked common dolphin, Delphinius delphis. It took Omar a moment to realize the coloring was wrong. These dolphins were more distinctly two-toned, and the colors were reversed. They had a dark ventral area, topped with a gleaming silver dorsal region.
"Professor, they're coloring."
"Yes, I see."
Wynne's voice was musing.
"Could we be looking at a new species?"
Omar cut the thrust of the submersible, letting it drift slowly up to the animals, which reacted with benign interest. One of them, a smaller specimen, even swam up to the little submarine as if to examine it. The others hung back. Omar expected that sort of behavior from dolphins. What he had not expected was the startling morphology.
"It has a neck," he murmured. "Professor, am I imagining?"
"No, no, you're not. Are the cameras rolling?"
"Yes, sir."
The animal now regarding them through the transparent cowling at the bow of the submersible apparently determined that they were no threat and turned to swim back to its fellows. In silhouette, the strangeness was emphatic. The rounded head with its tapered beak was set on a short, thick neck that joined the body just forward of a pair of long, narrow fins, flowing into the torso via sloping shoulders. Omar knew without a doubt that this was a species no one had seen before. What was it doing in a relatively shallow trench off the coast of Gibraltar? They deployed both of the Institute's smallest submersibles to capture the animals. The dolphins followed Icky II back to the ICI base in Roja Harbor, so it was a relatively simple combination of luring and herding. The six abnormal dolphins were of different sizes, though none seemed to be immature. Up close, their coloration was even more striking. There were subtle nuances to both the light and dark colors of their gleaming skin, and the patterns of light and dark on their beaks was highly individualized. Their behavior was typical of dolphins. They were curious to a fault, poking into every nook and cranny of their new habitat. It was an enormous tank, both deep and wide, and stocked with marine animals and plants common to the waters around Gibraltar. They made themselves comfortable almost immediately, surprising everyone by eating the kelp in the tank while ignoring the fish. They also seemed affably interested in the humans, which Omar found odd. If they were a species that had never interacted with humans before, why were they so friendly? He raised that with Professor Lerner when the staff gathered to get their first look at the newcomers.
"It may be an instinctive behavior rather than learned,"
Wynne Lerner told him.
"I can't imagine that humans have had contact with these creatures before or they'd exist in our records."
"Maybe they do," said Song Park, the newest of the ICI's research assistants. "They remind me of Inuit and Salish depictions I've seen of dolphins. Maybe ancient Aboriginal societies came across them." Dr. Lerner smiled at her observation.
"Not a bad theory, Song."
While the research team weighed their new acquisitions and took DNA samples, Dr. Lerner alerted the media, offering video and high-res still photos to media outlets and other research organizations. The creatures were calm throughout, only becoming agitated when the team attempted to tag them. It took an hour to insert subcutaneous chips in the left fins of each dolphin to enable tracking when they were later released back into the Alboran Sea. The team set up to observe the new species in a scale model of their familiar habitat. Omar, who worked the night shift monitoring the Institute's specimens, wondered what they thought of their new environment. It was much like the canyon they'd occupied previously in that it formed a rocky cul-de-sac on three sides, but unlike it in that it had a thick sheet of transparent plexiglass on the fourth side.
This fronted onto a gallery from which a number of habitats could be observed. Omar watched the new arrivals press their beaks against the plexi-panel repeatedly, and daydreamed about what they made of the human observers on the opposite side, busy tapping away on their iPads. It was a funny sight, one that had Omar picking up his own iPad to sketch a cartoon of the scene. He was infamous at ICI for his comic depictions of the staff and specimens. Everyone enjoyed it, except for Felix Berrocal. He was a post-grad from the Universitat de Barcelona. A tall, statuesque fellow with sleek black hair and a distinctly Moorish angularity of feature. He was scathing of Omar's depictions of him as a romance novel hero, typically striking poses before a bevy of stunned high school girls while delivering soliloquies on the mating habits of sea cucumbers. Felix accused Omar of rank envy. There was a grain of truth to that, Omar had to admit. Omar was half a head shorter than the Spaniard, and his profusion of unruly hair and raw sienna skin hinted at a heritage that was more Incan than Iberian. Then there was the fact that Felix had shown an immediate and obvious attraction to song from his first day on staff. Omar had been mesmerized by the petite Korean from the moment he saw her, but had quietly given up on any idea of asking her out. Song was among the group of studious dolphin watchers he was now sketching. He was especially careful with her likeness. Perhaps out of spite, he drew Felix behind her, looming like a vampire or a vulture. He did quick renderings of the several other scientists in the group, made two vertical slashes to represent the thick wall of the habitat, then began to sketch the dolphins. They bobbed in a ragged line right up against the plexiglass, watching the humans as intently as the humans were watching them. As Omar finished the cartoon, two of the animals swam away and disappeared into a stand of kelp. Chuckling, he sketched the two dolphins leaving the pod and dashed in a caption of one saying to the other, with an oblique backward glance at the humans, "I don't know, Agnes. I think that has got to be the most boring species in the aquarium. They never do anything." Omar heard a decidedly female giggle in his left ear and felt hair brush his cheek. He nearly jumped out of his skin and swiveled his chair. Song stood behind him, trying to cover her laughter with one elegant hand. "Omar, that is so funny," she said in delicately accented English. "Can I see?" He allowed her to pluck the pad from his unresisting fingers. Still laughing, she studied the drawing. "Oh, I see Dr. Wynne, and there's Nate, and Cecily. Oh, that is so very Felix." She met his gaze over the top of the pad. "Is that me?" Omar shrugged.
"It's not a very good likeness. I'm a total amateur."
"I think you're very good, but you make me so pretty."
"You are pretty, I think."
He cleared his throat. She blushed.
"What's so Felix?"
he asked, desperate to change the subject. She handed the iPad back and struck a predatory pose with her hands forming claws. "Like that, like a...
vampire?"
Her laughter was like the peal of silver bells. "Yes! Funny! Does that make me a blood donor?" While Omar tried to decide what to make of that remark, Song glanced up at the monitors and said, "Oh, look! The dolphins are all leaving. I guess they do think we're boring." Omar had to wonder if they still thought that after the team snatched two of them, a male and a female, for more detailed analysis. The animals were tranquilized and carefully relocated to shallow examination tubs, where they could be x-rayed and subjected to a variety of other imaging techniques. Wynne Lerner led the examination team, which included Felix and Song, while Omar held down the fort in the observation center, watching the other dolphins react to the absence of their comrades. They were agitated, extremely so. They scoured the habitat for the missing animals, even resorting to piercing vocalizations. Omar had to leap to turn down the audio gain on the mics in the habitat, they got so loud. Up until then, the creature's vocal output had been entirely beyond the range of human hearing, and Omar had been recording it using what amounted to a recalibrated seismic array. Now, the animals went through a series of clicks, burst pulses, and whistles, all the while zipping around the tank and bumping their beaks on the plexi panel. The dolphins seemed so distraught, Omar grew anxious by association. When they swam to the surface and launched into a chorus of what sounded like soprano and alto whale songs, he thought his heart would break. He remembered a female shortbeak they'd brought in earlier that year, whose calf had become entangled in a discarded parasail. Watching them reunite was one of the most emotional things Omar had ever witnessed. The memory made him wish he could somehow calm these animals, assure them that their missing companions were okay. On impulse, he got up and slipped out of the observation room into the gallery, which was a short walk down a broad, sloping corridor. He hurried, though he knew Lerner and the team would be at their task for at least another half hour. He went to the center of the dolphin's aquarium window and looked up at them. The moment they saw him, they swam down. The female who came closest to the window greeted him with a whistle and a series of clicks and pulses. He moved right up to the plexiglass and pressed a hand to it, willing the creatures to know that the two missing dolphins weren't lost, that they were simply being examined and would be back soon, healthy and whole. The female brought her face level with Omar's and touched her beak to the plexiglass. He tried his best to meet her gaze, impossible really because of the placement of her eyes, but in a moment she stopped vocalizing and floated back to her fellows. They seemed calmer now, less agitated. Omar heard voices at the top of the corridor and bolted back to his lair. Wynne came in a moment later, trailed by Song, Felix, and Cecily. They were still comparing notes about the results of their imaging session, which had apparently shown that the dolphin's internal physiology was almost as unusual as the exterior.
"I suspect," said Cecily, who was Wynne's wife and research partner, "that we're looking at a species that has been separated from the larger population of dolphins for millennia, in much the same way that Australian species of land mammals became separated from kindred species."
"Yes," said Felix, "but we're talking about marine life forms. How does one separate populations of marine life to that extent, given that the world's oceans are contiguous?"
Wynne moved to stand behind Omar's chair.
"There are a handful of bodies of salt water in the world that are cut off from the oceans. Is it possible that one of these might have suffered a breach?"
The dialogue suddenly ceased. Omar registered that, but was busy watching the dolphins circling their habitat like anxious fathers-to-be in a maternity ward.
"Omar?"
prompted Wynne.
"Dios mío, Navarro," said Felix. "Must you always be daydreaming?"
Omar swung away from the displays.
"I wasn't daydreaming. I was observing the dolphins, Barocal. I'm sorry, Doctor, I didn't realize you were talking to me." "You're the geology expert, yes?"
said Felix. Omar shot a dagger-sharp glance at him, but nodded.
"The only body of salt water I can think of that might have the right conditions would be the Black Sea. It's possible, I suppose, that some widening or deepening or current outflow in the Bosphorus might have allowed them to slip through, but, I mean, wouldn't they have been noticed before? The Black Sea's not that large."
"Yes, but who would expect to find a species of dolphin there?" Song asked quietly.
"Nobody. But last year a geological survey group began mapping the sea floor."
Song's eyes lit up. "Perhaps this prompted the dolphins to flee." Omar had to admit there was a logic to that. Certainly the dolphins, which Felix the suck-up had already begun to call Lerner's dolphins, must have originated somewhere secluded and recently been forced or enticed into leaving. The Black Sea made the most sense.
"I think it would be fascinating," said Cecily, "to do some sleuthing in the area to see if there are any local legends about large creatures in the Black Sea. I believe I'll contact that survey team, too, see if they've observed these creatures during their mapping project."
She pivoted on one heel and strode briskly from the room. Her husband shot her retreating form a look of affectionate approval, then turned to peer at the monitors.
"Interesting,"
Wynne said.
"They seem to be quite placid. I'd have expected them to be agitated over the disappearance of their fellows." "Oh, they were," said Omar. "They were all over the tank searching for them. They started vocalizing." "Really? Would you locate that and replay it, please?"
The group in the observation center watched the recording as the dolphin's agitation reached a fever pitch,
then calmed once the alpha female paid a visit to the viewing gallery.
"Look at that," murmured Wynne. "They just calmed right down. I wonder what caused it. What were they looking at through the plexi panel? Any ideas, Omar?"
Omar flushed. He knew exactly what they'd been looking at.
They were looking at me.
He felt the three pairs of eyes on him and quailed.
I could feel how distressed they were. I thought maybe I could calm them down. So I went out into the gallery and put my hand on the window and... that.
He pointed to the playback, in which the boldest of the dolphins had swum forward to put her beak against the plexiglass.
"That's it?"
asked Felix.
"You just put your hand on the glass and she came and kissed it?" "I don't know what she did. I just thought at them that their friends would be back and they'd be okay."
"You thought at them?"
repeated Wynne.
"What made you do that?"
"Yes,"
said Felix, slanting a mocking smile at Omar.
"Are you now Navarro, dolphin whisperer?"
Omar ignored the Spaniard and considered the professor's question.
"It just felt like if I could feel their unease so strongly, maybe they could feel my calm."
"Extraordinary,"
said Wynne. "Extraordinary," echoed Song. The admiration in her eyes made Omar's heart skip a beat.
"Well,"
Wynne said brusquely,
"this bears looking into. I'd like your written observations, if you please, Mr. Navarro, by tomorrow afternoon."
Omar nodded, not missing the rapier-sharp glance he got from Felix. He'd come up in the world. He was Mr. Navarro now. Lerner turned and exited the room, waving for Felix to follow.
"Felix, let's go grab a couple of the interns and get the beta male and female back into the tank, shall we? It will be interesting to see how the others react to having them reintroduced to the habitat."
The moment they were gone, Song crossed to Omar's chair, put her hand on his arm, and said,
"You have a most wonderful gift, Omar, the gift of empathy."
He felt heat creep up his neck.
"Oh, no, I probably imagined that whole..."
He gestured at the monitors.
"No, the video clearly shows you didn't imagine it. Something you did calmed those animals down. I think Felix is perhaps right. You are a dolphin whisperer."
She smiled and squeezed his arm, then turned and disappeared into the corridor. The reintroduction of the beta male and female was interesting. After an initial burst of whistles, the other dolphins gathered around them, silently, and nosed them, giving Omar the sense of eavesdropping on a conversation. Then, instead of going back to their normal routine of eating and swimming and playing, they seemed to enter a high state of agitation again, swimming in tight circles and pausing to confront each other. When a couple of the staff scientists approached the gallery window, all six of the animals disappeared into the kelp. Felix, Nate, and the learners were mildly bemused. Song was frowning. Omar's stomach tied itself in knots. That same rush of distress he'd felt earlier when the dolphins reacted to the disappearance of their comrades returned. He vaguely registered that the others had left the monitoring room and contemplated going into the gallery to see if he could do some more dolphin whispering. He almost leapt out of his skin at a gentle touch on his arm.
"What is it, Omar?" Song asked. "What do you feel?"
He ought to be embarrassed, he told himself, but couldn't muster the macho for that.